From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. And on this day, Maine's legislature left Augusta last week before approving the state's education funding bill. And the amount that Maine State Police are making in overtime is way up. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
First tonight, Maine communities are getting ready for their annual town meetings in which important decisions will be made about local tax rates. But that process could be difficult if the Maine legislature fails to act on a $1 billion plus school funding bill that lets school districts know what their share of total education costs will be. A.J. Higgins has the details.
Last week's lengthy debate over Medicaid expansion, the state tax code, and other issues triggered some procedural delays in the Maine House that prevented lawmakers from taking action on several other important bills, including school funding. And Democratic House Speaker Sarah Gideon says because House Republicans failed to endorse an extension of the legislative session, time is running out.
Right now we're in a situation where we're still in session, but we only have one legislative day left.
Parties in both chambers are in discussions trying to determine what day next month would be appropriate to convene for a veto session to address bills rejected by the governor and to take up those bills that were not dealt with last week. Gideon says the danger in not preparing to extend the session is that any of those measures could be subject to a pocket veto by Governor LePage.
That means that he vetoes them without the ability for the legislature to come back into session and to address those vetoes. It means, in other words, a certain death for bills at the governor's discretion. And that's not, you know, a position we necessarily want to be in.
Although Senate Republicans and Democrats were prepared to move on the bills last week, minority Republicans in the House have remained determined to influence the fate of several pieces of key legislation. House GOP leader Ken Fredette says that rather than square off against his party and the governor, Democrats should come back to Augusta willing to work within that one-day time frame.
And I think what we really want to see is people all coming to the table with a recognition that we need to work together to get this done. And what that means is that House Republicans are going to have an equal seat at the table. And it's this stuff is all going to get done and worked out, but it's not going to be something that's going to be dictated. And I think it's something that has to also involve a conversation with the governor. And that's how I think we find the path forward.
Senate Republicans such as Joyce Maker of Calais are hopeful that the school funding bill can be dealt with when lawmakers return for veto day, as long as everyone arrives to work with the right attitude.
I believe if we ever go back to set aside the bills, we'll put our big pants on and do our job.
Lawmakers can expect to hear more on this issue from constituents. The Maine School Management Association has sent out letters to school superintendents asking them to contact their elected representatives and urge them to act on school funding. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
U.S. Senate candidate Eric Brakey is asking the Maine Secretary of State to recommend a criminal investigation into his Republican primary opponent, Max Lynn, for fraudulent ballot petitions. Lynn's attorney is not objecting. In fact, he says he agrees, but he doesn't think it should disqualify Lynn from the ballot. Steve Missler has more.
The request to bring in the Maine Attorney General's office came at the end of a second probe into whether Lynn has enough valid signatures to qualify for the June primary election. About 45 minutes into Tuesday's hearing before Secretary of State Matt Dunlap, Lynn's attorney, Stephen Juskowicz, used one word to describe the array of irregularities uncovered by Brakey's campaign: hanky-panky. The dictionary describes hanky-panky as questionable or underhanded activity. But Josh Tardy, the attorney representing Brakey, and his political director, David Boyer, says the forgeries and questionable notary signatures on Lynn's ballot petitions are more than just political chicanery.
The hanky-panky that exists here is an astounding level. And beyond this actual petition challenge, I think the Brakey campaign and Mr. Boyer are requesting that the secretary exercise your discretion and refer this matter, regardless of your decision, to the Attorney General's office for the appropriate criminal investigation.
Brakey is attempting to unseat independent U.S. Senator Angus King this fall, but he drew a late primary challenger in Lynn, a financial planner and former Florida resident who has deployed rhetoric echoing the substance and style of President Donald Trump. Brakey's campaign challenged whether Lynn had the 2,000 valid signatures needed to qualify for the primary ballot. The Secretary of State then tossed out more than 200 of Lynn's signatures because his petitions included duplicates and forgeries of people who were dead. That left Lynn with 2,018 signatures, just 18 above the qualifying limit. But Brakey's campaign appealed once more in Kennebec Superior Court, which remanded the challenge back to the Secretary of State to review additional evidence of irregularities. Brakey's camp has now presented new evidence of 45 questionable signatures, a number that could disqualify Lynn from the ballot. Juskowicz, Lynn's attorney, acknowledged the irregularities and even suggested that someone engaged in fraudulent behavior. But he said that should not disqualify dozens of signatures on a single petition, because the law requires that Brakey's camp prove the intent to commit fraud, not merely find it.
Trust me, if I had an inkling of who might have done it and why, I'd tell you, because it makes my job easier. They have the burden of showing bad things, and if I knew what the bad thing was and how it happened and who did it, then it would make your job easier too.
Secretary of State Matt Dunlap will now recommend whether the new evidence is enough to disqualify Lynn. The final decision will be in the hands of Kennebec Superior Court Judge William Stokes, who has scheduled a hearing for Wednesday morning. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
And since Steve Missler filed this story late this afternoon, Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap has made a recommendation that U.S. Senate candidate Max Patrick Lynn has not met the threshold to be eligible for the primary ballot. After hearing the evidence, the statement says that Dunlap's office says 1,990 valid signatures were left. That's 10 fewer than the minimum required to qualify for the primary ballot. It is too late to change printed ballots, but if Dunlap's recommendations stand, Lynn's name will appear. Voters, though, will be given the information that he's no longer a candidate. Kennebec County Superior Court Justice William R. Stokes is expected to hear oral argument tomorrow morning regarding Dunlap's decision. This morning, 19-year-old Alan Monga of Westbrook stepped on stage in the first round of the Poetry Out Loud National Finals in Washington, D.C. Monga took a breath, exhaled, and recited W.E.B. Du Bois' 1907 poem, The Song of the Smoke.
I am the smoke king. I am black. I am swinging in the sky. I am ringing worlds awry.
But if it wasn't for a federal judge's ruling, that performance likely would not have happened. That's because while Monga won Maine's Poetry Out Loud competition last month, he wasn't considered eligible for the national finals because of his immigration status. Robbie Feinberg has that story.
When Alan Monga immigrated to Portland last summer, he sought asylum from his home country of Zambia. That means he wasn't classified as a U.S. citizen or permanent resident, which is a requirement to take part in the Poetry Out Loud National Finals. So earlier this month, Monga took the festival's organizer, the National Endowment for the Arts, to court and asked a judge to let him compete. Monga's lawyers argued that the NEA's rules discriminated against him and others. In a ruling on Friday, U.S. District Judge John Woodcock granted Monga's request to participate, ruling that the NEA's regulations would harm Monga by not letting him compete in a, quote, unique, fleeting, one-time opportunity. On Tuesday morning, Monga took that opportunity and performed two works, The Song of the Smoke and Lord Byron's poem, She Walks in Beauty.
One shade the more, one rather less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress.
Monga didn't make it to the competition's final round, which takes place Wednesday, but his lawsuit against the National Endowment for the Arts is still ongoing. While the judge allowed Monga to participate in the national finals, he has yet to make a final decision determining whether the NEA's eligibility rules are unconstitutional. And that decision could have an impact on future competitors. Portland Public Schools Superintendent Javier Botana says his district has many students who are seeking asylum. Botana says the district is talking with lawyers about how to make sure those students will be eligible for future competitions, whether by continuing the lawsuit against the NEA or by petitioning state and local organizers directly.
But clearly, from our perspective, it has to change. We can't have our students in this situation going forward.
The NEA's rules are still present on the Poetry Out Loud website. Asked if they would be changed, a spokesperson for the agency had no comment. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
In the Sunday Telegram this week, reporter Eric Russell looked at overtime in the Maine State Police. Looking at payroll data, Russell found that police staff took home more than $5.6 million in overtime last year. Russell joins me in the studio now to talk about this report and why it matters. Eric, how did you first get interested in the question of how much overtime state police are working?
There have been stories in other parts of the country, particularly in bigger metropolitan police departments, Chicago, Detroit, Boston, Nashville, to name a few, where police overtime has been a significant issue and has led to some calls for reform. And we get state payroll data periodically. Every year we request it. And oftentimes it reveals nothing, and sometimes it reveals something interesting. So we started looking through that data and did some data analysis, and this is what we had come up with. Now, that 30% increase over 5 years, which I reported, it seems like a lot, you know, on its face, but compared to some of the other increases in other places that I mentioned before, it's actually pretty modest. One of the things that we thought was interesting, though, was, you know, that concentration of overtime among some of the top folks. I mean, if you look at some of the people that made $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, even $97,000 just in overtime, that was pretty staggering.
How did that play out?
There wasn't one specific reason behind the overtime increases. There's a lot more special detail escorts. One of the things that was pretty interesting was windmill escorts. Every time a windmill piece, and these are massive pieces of equipment, as you probably know, every time they come up the interstate and go to Arista County or Piscataquis County or another place in Maine, they require two state police escorts. Now, in those instances, the state police are reimbursed by the company that does the transporting. So if you're a windmill manufacturer or a windmill operator, you're paying the cost. But the state police trooper who does that detail still gets the overtime.
Yeah. Who pays for all this overtime? Is it mostly the state or is it mostly outside entities?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix from what I was able to determine, although I had requested a full breakdown of how much is being reimbursed, and I didn't get that for this publication. The lieutenant colonel said he couldn't access that information in time. But the way he termed it was a majority of that overtime is reimbursed. In other instances, you know, where guys are filling in for you know, sick days or vacancies, and there have been some vacancies, that's obviously paid by taxpayers and paid by through the state police budget.
We have seen stories in the news looking at the problems that police forces in Maine are having attracting new recruits. How does this relate to this overtime pay increase, and what's at stake?
It's no secret that Maine State Police and other municipal or county-level police agencies are having a hard time both recruiting and retaining employees, and certainly because they haven't been able to fill all the positions at any given time, that's going to create shortages, staffing shortages. The colonel, the lieutenant colonel that I spoke with said that they've done a better job at filling those vacancies over the last couple of years. I think he said 2 years ago there were 36 vacancies agency-wide, and that's down to 14.
What are the concerns here?
Well, I mean, if you listen to the explanation from the lieutenant colonel and from the union official, they don't see this as a big problem. And I think overtime is seen as sort of a necessary evil. But when you're getting into major overtime for a handful of people, there's always the risk of safety. You know, safety in any job is important, but critically with state police, I mean, you're in any police, you're asked to make split-second decisions. So if you've been working 70 hours a week on average for many, many weeks, you know, there's always that risk that your reaction time is reduced, that your judgment is maybe limited. You know, from everything that I heard from the folks here, they do a pretty good job at managing it. But, you know, that doesn't change the fact that there are still a number of officers that are working a lot of hours.
All right. Eric Russell is a reporter with the Portland Press Herald and Sunday Telegram. You can find a link to his story and a longer version of this interview on our website at mainepublic.org. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.